Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You listen once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. We have a powerful show for you today, one of the most powerful shows we have had in the history of Religion Means Alive. We have one of the first-rate intellectuals of our time. And I just would have to give you an introduction to our brother and our friend, the great, noble, and honorable Platel Benjamin. I'm going to read some biographical information for you so you would know what we have our brother and friend, a great debater. And each day I'm just amazed more and more by him and find out how much we share in common. Platel George Benjamin is the producer of commentaries on the Times, which he writes and delivers on WBAI Radio in New York City, and a producer of The Midnight Ravers, a long-running show exploring the world of art and politics, which has won several radio awards for excellence and programming. He's an award-winning journalist and has been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize in different categories, Explanatory Journalism, Village Voice in 1988, and Distinguished Commentaries. I'm sorry, dear people. Commentary at New York Daily News, 1995. As a part of the production team for The Midnight Ravers, Mr. Benjamin won a 2011 award for excellence in radio program given by the Curtis Mayfield Special. Platel has won several prizes ranging from the Unity Award presented by the School of Communications at Lincoln University of Missouri for distinguished commentary on race relations, the Griot Prize for excellence in covering a story requiring exploration of African-American history and culture, quote, who is listening to Louis Farrakhan, end quote. It was awarded by the New York Chapter of the Association of Black Journalists in December 89. In 1991, Mr. Benjamin won the NYABJ Magazine Award for Feature Stories, and in 1996, he won the first annual Tom Forcade Award for Honesty and Accuracy in Drug Reporting, awarded by High Times Magazine for his columns on drug use and abuse in the New York Daily News. From 1991 to 1996, Platel was a regular contributor to the Guardian Observer of London, where he wrote on politics, culture, and sports. He's also wrote for the Sunday Times London, particularly in the prestigious magazine The Culture, which addresses cultural matters high and low. In the London Guardian, he wrote feature stories ranging from television coverage of Los Angeles riots sparked by the Rodney King incident to the courtroom genius of the great First Amendment lawyer Martin Garbus, as well as the O.J. Simpson trial, the Mike Tyson rape trial, the inauguration of Bill Clinton's concerts at Lincoln Center, and the Sister Soldier versus Bill Clinton incident. Mr. Clinton's saxophone playing was also subjected to serious critical evaluation in an essay titled, "He May Be the Leader of the Western World, But Will He Ever Be the President of the Saxophone?" That's enough. There's a lot more you can read in these times. By the great Platel Benjamin, scholar, intellectual, first rate. And we share a lot in common. I mean, he and I came up of age. We are aware of some of the same people. I want to welcome him to Religion Means Alive. And for the sake of brevity, I want to launch right into a subject that I want him to talk about. It's the Black Lives Matter movement and its confrontation with William Jefferson Clinton, the former president of the United States of America. And I think that as a referee and intellectual, Professor Platel Benjamin was also at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and the founding member of that department. African American Studies, I think the first African American Studies program in the United States. Welcome to Religion Means Alive and delve into your subject. We're going to talk like jazz musicians. Professor Platel Benjamin.
How you doing, Imam?
I'm well, man. I'm ready for it, brother. I'm in the corner. I want to be like Boondini Brown.
I just want to say one thing.
I want you to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee.
I just want to say one thing. Right now, you know, I write and publish the commentaries on the Times. It's www.commentariesonthetimes.wordpress.com. There are 700 essays on that site, and they cover all of the major issues of our time, national and international, mostly about politics, but there are a lot of essays on culture, too, music, film, theater, what have you. Matter of fact, I'm just finishing a piece right now on a one-man play that this brother Tommy Moore Jr. did on the life of Jack Johnson, which is really, really fabulous. You know, but in any case, and also also working on a piece on this new movie on Miles Davis. But the Black Lives Matter movement. Let me say first of all about this is that I have had a long interest in mass transformative movements, study of this. I've been studying this. I have been involved with either building and studying mass movements for close to 50 years. As a matter of fact, it has been 50 years. I met Dr. Luther P. Gerlach, who is now passed on. He was a German-American professor at the University of Minnesota. I met him around 1966. There was a race riot in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul. And everybody was shocked because they didn't think they had a race problem there. And I was surprised, too, because I had been through there 4 years earlier when I got out of service, and it seemed to me that this was a really racially harmonious place. So when they had this race riot, everybody was shocked about, well, what's going on? So I was working with Reverend Leon Sullivan at the time in Philadelphia, you know, in a program called OIC. And I had set up a black studies, actually it was a minority group history program I had set up, but it really was based in, you know, the study of Afro-Americans and Puerto Ricans at the time. And this was, you know, at the beginning of what was called the Great Society or the War on Poverty. So there was all this money out here, but nobody really knew how to fight poverty. I mean, this was a new thing. So everybody was coming from all over the country to visit this program that Sullivan had set up in Philadelphia. And when they came, they would take them on a tour. Well, one of the places they would take them is to my classes. And so they could let them peep in on my lectures. Well, it got to the point where they had to bring these tours to my class last because when people came, they didn't want to leave. And that includes Robert Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. When he was president, he came there. But this minister from Minnesota, Stan King, Reverend Stan King, had come to visit just a couple of weeks before, and he visited my class, and he sat there, and he listened. And so when this riot jumped off and everybody was all puzzled, they wanted to know, you know, what happened, what's going on in this country. So he said, I know somebody who could explain it. And he got them to hire me, he got the city to bring me into the Twin Cities to do a series of lectures about race relations in America. Well, this professor, Luther Gerlach, was watching on television, you know, when I came. He saw me speak. And so he showed up at my next speech, and he told me he would like to talk to me. He told me that, you know, he was doing this serious research on mass movements, and that's probably the most advanced person around, you know, dealing with this question. And it was a revelation to me, the things he had to teach, and things I learned from him, I still apply when I'm looking at movements. And what he was doing was, he was a social scientist, you know, actually he was a social anthropologist. And what he was interested in was he was looking at social movements as a class of phenomenon. Now, this is an interesting concept. That is to say that he was trying to find out what things do social movements have in common. You know, is there a set of rules that mass transformative movements follow? And if there is a set of rules, these rules ought to be able to see these same things play out in mass movements no matter where you look at them in the world. It doesn't matter. Geography will have no effect on this and on this model, and neither would time, neither time nor space. That these, he was looking for a general theory of how mass movements operate. He had developed this theoretical model, which was amazing. Now, at the time, I was involved in the movement. At the time, I was involved with the Revolutionary Action Movement, RAM. You know, we were, you know, the first group of the 1960s to talk about taking up arms and all that. And that's another question. Sometime I'd be glad to talk to you about that bit of folly that I was lucky to survive. But nevertheless, we were quite serious about it, and we were part of the overall black movement. And what this guy said, he asked me, you know, if he could meet with me. He wanted to show me what he was doing. So I met with him, and what he had to tell me was, like, really fascinating, and he also identified my role in the movement. He told me, he said, you are a charismatic revivalist. He showed me a model of what elements the movement had to have in order to succeed. And charismatic revivalists are the speakers that you see that will rise up out of, like what you do, mass orators who rise up in every movement, without whom there can be no mass movement. That these are people who embody the aspirations of the people and are able to give them this message. This is what charisma is. This is the essence of charisma. Anyway, and that's what Malcolm was, that's what Martin Luther King was, and it doesn't matter what your ideology is. It doesn't matter whether you're on the right or on the left, whether it's a religious organization or a secular organization. He had a model that explained mass transformative movements across all of these different variations. Now, when I look at social movements, no matter where I look at them at, I'm using this theoretical framework, right? So, for instance, if you go to commentaries on the times, there's a whole section on the Arab Spring, a little section called on War and Peace. You know, you could put Arab Spring in there. You could look and you can read my analysis of these movements in the Arab world in real time. This is written in real time. And you can see now that this stuff reads like prophecy. I predicted, for instance, that in Egypt, when everybody was saying that, oh, you know, they're going to overthrow the military dictatorship in Egypt and the Muslim Brotherhood is not going to play any role, they're going to create this democratic society and whatnot, I wrote a piece saying this is nonsense. I wrote a piece saying that when the smoke clears, the Muslim Brotherhood is going to be in charge. And when the smoke cleared, who was in charge? The Muslim Brotherhood. All right? And I explained how it was going to happen. I explained this before it happened. Same thing with the Occupy Wall Street movement. There's a section on commentaries on the time called on the Occupy Wall Street movement. If you read those essays and read them and they're dated, you can see them, you'll progress. You will see that that also reads like prophecy. Notre Dame would gladly claim these essays, is there, because they predicted exactly what was going to happen.
All right, free.
It's not that I have a crystal ball. It's that I have a deep understanding of how these things operate, both from having participated in them and having studied them now for over 50 years. This is 1966. 1966, what is this, 2016? That was what? How many years ago? That was, you know, that was 50 years ago, this year, 50 years ago, that I first started studying this. So I've been studying this a long time. So when I look at the Black Lives Matter movement, aside from who the personalities are involved, aside from what their cause is, any of that, first thing I want to look at is, you know, what are their chances of success? You know, do these people understand the things you have to do in order to build a successful movement? And the fact is that they don't, you know. And people have to understand that it doesn't matter whether your cause is just. You know what I mean? Your cause can be just and all that, and you can still fail. You know, there's certain things you have to do. One of the things you have to do in the situation here is, in the end, you have to identify allies. You know, you have to be able to tell, you know, who your friends are from who your foes are. You know, and in terms of strategy, you have to be able to understand what the principle of an alliance is. An alliance does not mean that you agree on everything. If you agreed on everything, there would be no reason for an alliance. You could just all be one big organization. The alliances, by their very nature, means that these are forces that only agree on certain issues and that they have differences. So the principle of building an alliance is to unite around those things which will promote your cause. Now, in the present situation, we have in the United States, two political parties. People can talk all they want about a third party, all that kind of crap. I will tell you this. I think the chances of any third party succeeding in the United States is about equal to the chances of a snowflake at a pizza oven. All right? Now, The reason is that if anybody was ever going to be able to successfully build a third-party movement, it would have been Theodore Roosevelt way back at the early 20th century. Here was a guy who was rich, came from a family with a great name. He was the epitome of the Anglo-Saxon warrior in a period when you were having a resurgence of Anglo-Saxonism in the United States and the rise of social Darwinism and eugenicism, where, you know, all this talk about the superiority of the blonde Teutonic race, the conquering Anglo-Saxon, and political parties were much less dug in, much less stable than they are now. If anybody was going to be able to do that, he would have been able to do it. But he tried to do it with the Boer Moose Party, and he failed. Now, every attempt at a third party since then has failed. So the point is that there's going to be a president of the United States elected this year. They're going to be a Democrat or a Republican. The question for anybody who is trying to build a movement for change is, which side, where do our allies lie? You're saying, you know, can we find allies among the Republicans? Is our best chance of finding allies for our cause among the Republicans or among the Democrats? Well, that's a fairly easy answer to a question answer. All you have to do is look at what the two parties stand for. Now, when we look at the people who are running on the Democratic Party, I mean, we have no choice. I mean, the Republicans offer us nothing, and anybody who thinks that they do is an idiot, you know, and it would be very easy for me to quickly dispense with any argument they want to make about that. The modern Republican Party was born and built on resentment of black advancement. The modern Republican Party, and this is well documented. I mean, if I had to name one single text that people who are really interested in studying this, if you really want to see this thing laid out in chapter and verse, you should read the book, The Politics of Rage, written by Dr. Dan T. Carter. Now, Dan T. Carter is a Bancroft Prize-winning Southern historian. He's an outstanding historian. And this book is the central text that will tell you how the Republicans went from a minority party nationally to a majority party that could elect a succession of presidents. And it was all built, the strategy was all built on the resentment of Southern whites, you know, and other whites, but basically in the South, what Nixon called the Southern strategy in the beginning, to bring those people who, after Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Omnibus Civil Rights Act, which destroyed segregation, de jure segregation, that is legal segregation in the South, and then signed the Voting Rights Act in 1965, he turned to Bill Moyers, who was his press secretary at the time, and said, "Bill, we've just handed the South over to the Republicans for a generation." Well, it's turned out to be more than a generation. Now, when I left the South, when I left Florida in 1960, the South was solidly Democratic. Now the South is solidly Republican. And why? What was the motive force? The motive force was racial resentment. Okay, so any black person who thinks that the Republican Party agenda can in any way address our aspirations is a fool. Okay, he's either a fool or a traitor to his race. Now, so we are with the Democrats. That's where we are, you know. And whatever leverage we're going to have in this political system, we're going to get through our participation with the Democratic Party. Now, I know that there are Marxists and others who take the position that, you know, there's going to be a revolution and all that. Listen, let me just explain one thing about that. I've written a piece about this called On the Burden of History, which is on the commentary. You can read where I go into this in some detail. You understand? The point is this. There's no instance in the history of the world where there has been an armed revolution in a country where people can vote the government out of office. Nowhere, you know. And it's not hard to understand that. If you can't convince people to vote for who you want, how are you going to convince them to pick up guns? You see? And why do they need to pick up guns? Well, they could just vote people out of office, you see. So in Lowndes County, Alabama, when we were talking about up here, when we were up here in New York and Philadelphia talking about taking up guns and all that, the black people in Lowndes County knew all they had to do to get rid of them crackers was to get the right to vote and vote their ass out of office, and that's what they did. You understand? They voted all them crackers out of office. It's not an accident that Strom Thurmond was running around, you know, kissing black folk butt at the end of his career, because black people had to vote in South Carolina now. You understand? If he offended them, he wasn't going to be in the Senate anymore. You know, so the point is that business, this stuff about armed revolution, all that is nonsense. You understand? Whatever changes that we're going to get in this country is going to come through the political process, period. You understand? And our best hope in this political process are the Democrats. Now, that being said, here we have two people running for the Democratic presidential nomination, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Well, the Black Lives Matter movement has mostly targeted them. The Black Lives Matter movement has mostly targeted Democrats, Bernie, and then Hillary. Why, if they want to target somebody on the race question, why aren't they harassing the Republicans? You know, this is the enemy. They don't even know who the enemy is. You know what I mean? They don't even know who the enemy is. And so they attack them, and now they have zeroed in, it appears, on the Clintons. Now, here's the problem. Even if you were for Bernie Sanders, and I'm for Bernie Sanders, you know, even if you for him, the chances are that Bernie is not going to get the nomination, you know, barring some miracle that I cannot foresee at the moment. That being the case, the Democratic Party will be represented by Hillary Clinton. So to demonize Hillary Clinton, to try to make her into some kind of monster, which she's not, you understand, to try to make her into some kind of monster means that you are cutting your own throat. You're cutting your throat to spite your face. So when I see these Black Lives Matter people run up on Bill Clinton the other day, first of all, they don't know what they're talking about. You know, these people do not understand politics nor history. And these are two great things, these are two fundamental things that you have to have a mastery of in order to build a successful political movement, a mass movement. Why? Because, first of all, if you don't understand history, as the great Harvard philosopher George Santayana said famously, and they love the quote, they love to quote it, but they don't really, you know, grasp its true meaning, when he says that those who refuse to learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat its mistake. Oftentimes when people say that, they'll say that, and then they begin to create a myth about what they want to believe happened. No. In order to learn the lessons of history, you have to look at the facts objectively, whether you like them or not. You know, you have to look at them objectively if you intend to learn something from it. Now, when the Occupy Wall Street movement, I started writing about it early on. They were camped right down the street from WBI. You know, I went down there, I took pictures, I interviewed them, and all these pieces are on the commentaries on the Times. Right away, I saw that this movement had a weakness that could kill it. And that weakness is that you would hear them say that we are above politics. John Lewis came down there, a great hero of the civil rights movement, and they wouldn't let him speak because he was a congressman. That was the kiss of death. In the United States, nothing is above politics. And the thing you need to understand about politics is that politics is the art of the possible. If it is not possible, it is not politic. If you're looking for somebody who is pure and perfect, and you should look in the church or the mosque or somewhere, you know, good luck with that, you understand? But certainly you should not be looking in politics, you know?
That's right.
Politics is not about personal perfect people. Politics is about what kind of deal can we put together and what is the best deal that we can get right now that will advance our interests, you know? And you will hear people say, somebody said to me the other day, I'm sick of this choosing the lesser evil. Well, I wrote a piece 16 years ago called On Choosing the Lesser Evil. It's on the commentaries. It's on the section titled On Dr. Cornel West, where I have a dozen essays on Cornel West, critical essays. And it begins with this essay 16 years ago, where I told them, when they were talking, one of them said, I heard somebody say, one of Ralph Nader's followers say, Ralph Nader's the Mother Teresa of politics. I got very nervous when I heard that. You understand what I'm saying? Because in politics, Mother Teresa is not what you need. You need Machiavelli in politics, right? So I said, oh, man, these people, you understand what I'm saying, these purists again, you know? And I wrote a piece called On Choosing the Lesser Evil, saying to them that, look, don't support Ralph Nader against Al Gore because he can't win. And you have to look at who the real enemy is and what the great danger. The great danger is that George Bush could be elected, and I predicted disaster would follow, and it did. But worse disasters than I ever thought followed the election of George Bush. He screwed up more than I thought he was going to screw up. Cornel West has never apologized for that, for talking people into voting for Nader and what have you. He's never apologized for it. He just helped create, he was midwife to a disaster, and he has just increased his lecture fees explaining the disaster that he helped create. You understand what I'm saying? So that's the reason why I regard it as, you know, as something of a charlatan. You know what I mean? But in any case, the problem with the Black Lives Matter people is that they have no understanding of history and even less understanding of politics. You cannot make an enemy out of everybody and think that you're going to be able to advance your cause. And the attack on Bill Clinton, as I say, is ahistorical. You know, I just had to comment about that on a piece of this young woman, this professor, Michelle Alexander. Look, I don't have any doubt that this woman is very sincere, you know, and I don't have any doubt that she's a competent law professor. But when she starts talking about the Clintons and the omnibus crime bill, she doesn't know what she's talking about. You know, she doesn't know what she's talking about. And she doesn't know what she's talking about either when she talks about that welfare reform bill. She doesn't, strangely enough, she's a law professor, but she doesn't understand politics. And then she said the other day that she had never heard of Bernie Sanders before this election began. And I'm supposed to, we're supposed to listen to her, you know, tell us something about politics, you know, and what is going on here. She wrote a response to what happened with Clinton. I wrote a response to it, and it was as different as night and day. My response is this. Bill Clinton signed that bill because black people all over the country begged him to sign it. We begged him to sign it. I wrote on here today, a piece I wrote today, I went down to Washington and took my children. I had twins, you know, who are, at the time they had twins, they were about 7 years old at the time. I took them down to Washington and personally lobbied the New York congressional delegation to pass this bill. Why? Because just the week before, they almost got caught in a shootout between two fucking dope dealers up here. You understand what I'm saying? And this was a fabulous neighborhood here. It is again now, you know, Sugar Hill. It is again now. The only one good thing Giuliani did was get rid of these dope dealers. And he had the help of this federal law, these federal laws that Bill Clinton, the Congress passed and Bill Clinton signed into law. We begged him to sign into law, and it did get rid of the crack trade. Now, you have these people who all of a sudden, the crack dealers who are sitting in jail, they're the victims, okay? And Michelle, I don't know how old this woman, Michelle Alexander, is, but she obviously does not remember this period and obviously was not living in one of these black communities that these dope dealers had turned into free fire zones where people were scared to go out to go to church. You understand? So that remedy was exactly the right remedy for the time. And to talk about it now, and most of these people in Black Lives Matter, they don't have no idea what happened. They just run in their mouth. They don't have any sense of history at all. I saw, for instance, the daughter of Eric Garner, the guy who was choked to death over at Staten Island selling Lucy's out on the street. Look, I mean, I'm sorry her father got killed, but that doesn't make her an expert on, you know, on politics or, you know, police community relations. It doesn't, you know. And I heard her out here talking about the Clintons, and she didn't have no idea what she was talking about. Not a clue. You know, and that's the problem. There are too many people running their mouth who don't have any idea what they're talking about, and you can't talk to them. You know, they are very arrogant. They think that because they're young, that they invested with some kind of special wisdom instead of understanding that wisdom comes with age and study. And right now, they're loose cannons, and anybody who tries to talk to them, they shout them down. You know. But Bill Clinton, Michelle Alexander says that he was rude to them. I don't think he was rude to them at all. The fact is, he was a lot more courteous to them than I would have been, you know, had they been in my face, had they been talking to me. I mean, he patiently tried to explain to them the circumstances under which this bill was passed, you know, and gave them some examples, you know, of the people they were trying to get. But now, you know, all that's forgotten, and these guys are sitting in jail for having wreaked havoc on the black community. We're supposed to feel sorry for them. Well, I don't. So my position on the Black Lives Matter movement is that they have a great cause, but they're misguided and they don't really know what they're doing. And if they continue down this road, they're going to end up just like the Occupy Wall Street movement. They're going to be like a comet that flashes across the sky, brings a lot of attention to itself, illuminate a few objects, and then they're going to disappear into nothingness. Where's the Occupy Wall Street movement now that we need them? Are you there?
Sure, I'm listening. I want to turn the conversation to the stop and frisk law, which you have opined on.
And well, I wrote about this.
Yes.
Yeah,
would you share with us your opinion before we go? Now, let me just identify station. This is Religion Means Alive. We're listening to the great professor, Paytel Benjamin, back from the West Coast, and one of the finest intellectuals. You know, Paytel, I don't know whether we share the same political view. Paytel is to the left of me. I mean, if Paytel had his ideal world, it would be a social world, socialist idea. But we agree on one thing, to have vigorous debates, vigorous discussion. And I just got a text message. If you were to identify for us the name of the person, professor you were talking about, the book about mass movement, and then continue on with your discussion of crime in our neighborhoods, stop and frisk, and how I believe that African Americans in these neighborhoods, it necessary need to exercise their Second Amendment rights and clean these neighborhoods up so we can live in them.
Well, first of all, the professor's name is Luther P. Gerlach, G-E-R-L-A-C-H, and you can look him up on Google. And he made a documentary film called People, Power, Change, and that's also the name of his book, People, Power, Change. And in this documentary, if you can find it, you may, and I decided to look for it recently, and I didn't, but if you can find it, I know it can be ordered. I'm in this documentary. When he talks about the role of charismatic revivalists, he has live footage of me speaking, you know, and he explains, look at the people, look at me, look at my hands, look at the relationship with me in the audience, and he shows what the charismatic revivalist does. He uses me in that example. In the film, but okay, stop and frisk. Let me just say this: it depends upon whether you think the criminals pose the greatest danger to the black community, or whether you think the police pose the greatest danger to the black community. I think the criminals do, and I think that that's fairly easy to prove. You know, all you have to do. It's just look at the statistics. Look at the statistics at which I give on commentaries on the Times. If you go there and you go to the search engine and put stop and frisk, you will see my essays on it. And I have all the statistics in there. The fact is that if you compare the number, let's take Chicago, for instance. You know, if you compare the number of black males that are killed by black criminals to those who are killed by white racists, in or out of uniform, you will see that the numbers are insignificant. Let me give you an example of how bad it is. At the height of lynching, during the period that the great Afro-American historian Rayford Logan calls the nadir, you know, this is the period between after the collapse of Radical Reconstruction, which occurred with the election of 1876 between Samuel J. Tilden, when they made a deal, you know, Rutherford B. Hayes and Samuel J. Tilden, and they made a deal that if the Republicans would concede the election results, because it was a contested election, that and if the Democrats would concede and allow the Republican candidate to take office, in return, they would remove all federal troops from the South and end Radical Reconstruction. Now, remember, the Reconstruction period after the Civil War, this is a period when, you know, when the Civil War was, you know, of course, it was not a planned event. You know, when Abraham Lincoln took office, he did not plan to have to fight a Civil War with the South. The South started seceding, you know. And when Senator Calhoun, John C. Calhoun, led this attack on Fort Sumter in South Carolina, when they actually fired on a federal fort, you understand, then these Southerners showed they meant business, and Abraham Lincoln understood that they had to be crushed. And so we went into what was at that time the greatest civil war, you know, in the history, the greatest war, This is the first modern war. The American Civil War is the first modern war. That was the most destructive war in history up to that time. There were more people killed in a single afternoon in the Battle of Gettysburg than has been killed in the whole 14 years of warfare in Iraq and Afghanistan. In one battle, the Battle of Gettysburg. That's how dangerous, that's how destructive this war was. And it had to do with advances in weaponry and technology, a lot of things. But anyway, the point is that this war was a very, very bitter, destructive war. And when it was over, the white Southerners, you know, they couldn't believe they had lost, and they were not prepared to surrender, and they wanted to take measures to try and re-enslave black people as quickly as they could. The 13th Amendment, the passage of the 13th Amendment, which, you know, had to be coerced, you know, by a lot of states to into signing it. In the Southern states, they couldn't re-enter the Union without ratifying the 13th Amendment. That's how they managed to get it ratified. But the 13th Amendment, now you have a constitutional amendment against slavery. So slavery was not coming back. So that was the end of it. So the question was, what could they do to reduce black people to as close a position to slavery as possible? And, of course, they came up with all kinds of things, you understand, and in an attempt to deal with that, to with the black codes, you know, the whole series of measures, and one of the main ones was white terror. The Ku Klux Klan was born in this period, the Knights of the White Camellia, all these white terrorist groups, you know, so they used extra legal means, terror, to keep black people, try to keep black people in their place. And then we got the passage of the 14th and the 15th Amendment. And then the 14th Amendment is particularly important because this contains the Equal Protection Clause. This is where, you know, we were guaranteed the same rights and protections as white folk. Now, in this period that followed, you know, when the white South were trying to reassert itself and they launched a war of terror, particularly after 1876 when the federal troops left the South, you know, and the white Southerners, the former Confederates, took over again. This was a period, a reign of terror, that lasted from 1876 up until around 1915. And in this period, this is the greatest period of outright white violence against black Americans. But in this period, a black person was shot, hung or burned alive every 2.5 days. Okay? Now, that's horrendous when you think about it. But if you think about the number, every 2.5 days, that's about, you know, maybe 150 people a year, which is way too many, you know. However, the little city of Oakland right now has had that many murders this year, just Oakland. Not to mention the country at large. The country at large, the figures are staggering. So you have more black criminals murdering black men right now than was murdered by white terrorists at the height of the race war in the United States. That's the fact of the matter. So when I hear these people with all these Black Lives Matter, yes, they do. And the first people you ought to tell that to is all of these thugs running around with guns, you know, just shooting up the place. They're the first people you need to tell that Black Lives Matter. And so I think stop and frisk, well, one of the arguments here in New York City, they said, well, you don't be stopping and frisking people and they named some white neighborhood in Brooklyn. And so they just presented the statistics to them. They said, you know, the neighborhoods we choose to have the stop and frisk program based upon the number of people who are killed and injured by gunfire. That's how we choose them. And I forget the exact statistic now, but it's in the piece. But I think that it was something like 13 times more people shot or killed with guns in this black section of Brownsville, Brooklyn, or East New York, than there was in the white section of Brooklyn that they were talking about. You understand? So to think that this is a racist plot. First of all, again, you know, not having knowledge of history really, really hurts people's ability to analyze what is going on now. I mean, as Benjamin Quarles, the great Afro-American historian who for many years was at Morgan State and who wrote the definitive books, The Negro and the American Revolution, you know, and The Negro and the Making of America, he pointed out once, he made the statement that those who would want to understand, who seek to understand contemporary events, need the added dimension of historical perspective. That is a fact. You understand? And if you don't know any of these facts I'm talking about, you understand, you can greatly exaggerate or misrepresent what is going on right now. But right now, there are more black men being killed by black criminals, you know, than ever was killed by white folks, you know, in the worst period, you know. My position was, you know, we should mend it, not end it. We should mend it. That I don't want white cops to be able to just walk up on anybody anytime and act any way they want to, because there are racists on the police force. You know, there are white boys who are suffering from penis envy on the police force. There are white boys who are jealous of the prowess of black male athletes and the way their girlfriends creaming their jeans over them. You know, there are white boys who are pissed off about all of these, look like everywhere, these interracial porn movies, you know, where they've got, you know, all these white girls all over white black men, you understand, everywhere. I mean, there are a lot of white boys, who are pissed off because they're a failure in the United States. They wish they were Donald Trump, which is why you got all these poor whites supporting Donald Trump. So I understand that there is a problem with racism, and there's a problem with white cops. I'm not dismissing that. But the way to deal with that is to record every stop, you know, so you see from beginning to end what happens, you know. And it would be a cause for dismissal if cops stop people and don't record it. So that's the way to deal with that. You know, we could deal with that. That's a technical problem. But to say that we should just throw out, you know, a stop and search altogether, this is a violation of, you know, your civil rights and that kind of stuff. Look, in a situation where you have casualties that are worse than those in a war zone, then you actually, there are legal means by which they can declare a state of emergency, you know, and do whatever they want. You understand? If these black criminals were killing white people on the east side the way that they're killing black people around here, they would declare a state of emergency and do whatever they wanted to do to stop it. So the point is that racists, this is the point I wanted to make, when they say that this is racist, that's another thing. Most of them don't know what real racism is, you know. I mean, I grew up in the South under apartheid. I'll be 74 years old on the 25th of this month, you know. I grew up under hardcore racism when them crackers didn't have no shame in their game. And the way a racist would respond to this was not the way the mayor of the city, Bloomberg, responded to this by spending all this money. You know, it cost the city money to conduct this stop and search program. It cost the city a lot of money. Where I grew up out in Florida, them crackers wouldn't have spent a dime to stop black people from killing black people. They wouldn't have stopped a dime, spent a dime. As long as it was kept in the black community, they would just say, if the niggas want to kill each other, go ahead and let them kill each other. But they would not have spent, you know, millions of dollars and whatnot trying to prevent it. So it's nonsense to say that it was a racist program. It was not a racist program. You know, it was a response to what law-abiding black people, to the cries of law-abiding black people who feel like hostages in their own community. Bloomberg knew this because he was going out visiting the churches all the time. You know, and this is where you see the law-abiding, family-oriented, you know, hard-working black folk. It's not the only place you see it, because my children didn't grow up in the church and whatnot, because I'm not religious. However, if you look at the black community as a whole, the fact is that most of the church-going people, where you want to find responsible, family-oriented people, you know, who get up and go to work every day and try to raise their kids, well, you will find more of them in the church than you find anywhere else, you know, and that's a fact. And so Bloomberg would visit the churches and hear what they had to say, and they didn't want them to stop it. You understand? The main people who wanted to stop it were criminals. Now, I can understand that, you know, the young black men who were going about their business and being stopped and that kind of stuff, but if this was being videotaped, you know, they would have to be very courteous about it, and they would be careful about it. They wouldn't abuse their power. But I don't know why, if somebody's trying to save your life, you know, you would be so up in arms about it. What would you rather be? Suffer some a minor inconvenience, or would you rather be dead from some gun-toting criminal? You know, that's the question, you know. And so
Professor, would you be for a use of Second Amendment, but legal citizens picking up arms to clean these neighborhoods up. You know, I remember in the 80s, and it was, you know, I used to live at 153rd St. Nicholas. I came back in 1987, and I could barely walk the streets. You know,
well, it was that's a very tempting idea. Let me tell you something. I actually wrote a piece about that. I wrote it in the Village Voice, but it's anthologized in a book called Violence in America, published by Evergreen Press, which you can get in the library. I wrote a piece called Power to the People, Death to the Dealers, Down with Crack. And this, I wrote this after my kids almost got caught in this crossfire by these crack dealers out here. And I live in a place, in a neighborhood that was, I mean, like I say, it's a wonderful neighborhood again now. But in the 80s, when they were kids, the same period you're talking about, it was like a war zone up here, you know? And I live in an apartment that Paul Robeson used to live in. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, I live in a place, this was a place where, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois, Duke Ellington, all of them lived up here, you know? And here we were now, not even able to, scared to go out and walk the damn street, you know? So at that point, I consider that as not, because here we were in this building. There were 9 black men in this building who were military veterans, people who had been Marines, who had been in the airborne, and I had been in a crack unit in the Strategic Air Command, whose job was to stop Russian saboteurs. I know how to use all kind of weapons, and we wanted to arm ourselves and take these guys on. You know, it would have been easy work for us, you know, to take these criminals on and wipe their ass out. Because first of all, none of them can shoot straight. And the reason they can't shoot straight is because they've never had any training with any guns. And that's the reason why they're always shooting the wrong people by accident. We would have made, as military men, we could have put together a search and destroy party in here and made short work of these guys. But if we did that, we were going to end up in prison like Rap Brown. That's the reason Rap Brown is in prison right now, because they took up arms against them drug dealers down in Atlanta. You understand? This brother Sahaj Mirage out here in Brooklyn, they got in trouble. If you take up guns against them, now you're a criminal. You're a vigilante. You understand? So what I think is this. I think that we should make the law enforcement do its job. You understand? Now, about the Second Amendment, let me say this. I've actually written a piece calling for the repeal of the Second Amendment. And so you can read it on read it on the commentaries. It's called A Gun Crazy Nation. It's time to repeal the Second Amendment. And I make a learned argument based upon the history of the period in the Constitutional Congress and what was going on. Because basically, this piece was designed to speak to these right-wing nuts, you know, who think that they should be able to have assault weapons, a bazooka, anything. And they attempt to justify it by saying that they're guaranteed this under the Second Amendment. And the way that they argue, you look at the National Rifle Association and this idiot Wayne LaPierre, the argument that he makes is that the Second Amendment was inserted into the Constitution to arm the people against the tyranny of our government. That's a lie. That's not true. There's no truth to that at all. You know, and if you're anybody who wants to talk, if you want to have me come on here another time and I'll actually read my piece and we can discuss it, you know what I mean? I'd be happy
to. Yes, I
will. But that's just not true. You understand what I'm saying? How do we know it's not true? You understand? Well, first of all, just a few months before the Constitutional Congress sat in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787, they had all witnessed Shays' Rebellion in Massachusetts, where a group of armed Massachusetts farmers, led by a guy who had been an officer in the Continental Army in the fight against England, who attempted to march on state government in Boston, and because they didn't want to pay taxes, you know, they didn't want to pay taxes on that, so they were going to actually overthrow the government. They actually formed a militia, you know, and took up arms against the government. Now they had just witnessed that, and that was a harrowing experience. And when they set down to draw up the Constitution of the United States, the last thing that they were going to do was to put any provision in there saying that it was all right for citizens to take up guns against the government. After all, you know, we elect our government, you know, and if you don't like it, you know, then we can change it. You know, you don't need to take up arms to change things here. You can change it, you know, at the ballot box. And so they definitely was not in favor of that. And George Washington himself, the only sitting president to actually lead an armed military party to put down a rebellion of armed citizens in the Whiskey Rebellion, you know, in Pennsylvania. You understand? So that's just not true. You know, there's no historical basis for such an argument at all, you know. The idea of the Second Amendment, and it says in there very clearly that the right to bear arms, you should take place within the context of a well-regulated militia, okay? And that well-regulated militia is the National Guard, the state National Guards that we have. You know, these people have taken it and distorted this meaning and come up with this bogus idea, you know, about what the Second Amendment means. And because there's such confusion about the Second Amendment, because these charlatans, even after children have been killed in their classroom and these mass killings everywhere with these assholes with these automatic assault weapons, that should never be. There's no reason for a citizen of this country to have military assault weapons. If you want to carry a military assault weapon, if you're a freak for military assault weapons, join the fucking Marines. I'm sorry, I have to watch my. Join the Marines, or join the airborne or the infantry. You know, there's a place where you can carry assault weapons if you really want to carry assault weapons. But walking around the streets out here and in the private homes of people, that's crazy. You understand? It's crazy. You know, and it's turned our society into a free fire zone. You don't know where you're at, where some fool might go up and start shooting. And they keep talking about terrorists. If you, Islamic terrorists, if you look at the number of people who have been killed in mass shootings, you know, since 9/11, it's overwhelmingly at the hands of American citizens. Overwhelmingly. You know, people who just, for whatever reason, you know, they pick up their gun and just go out and start shooting and just shoot up a whole lot of people. And these Republicans are in the complete grip of the National Rifle Association. And so no matter what they do, they refuse to take any kind of reasonable position on gun control. And that's why I wrote this piece calling for the repeal of the Second Amendment, because as long as the Second Amendment is there, we're going to have these silly ass arguments, you know, about what it means. So get rid of the Second Amendment, and then you don't have no right to have a gun. And if you do get a gun, you will have to apply and you will have to show a reason why you have to have it. You understand? But this idea that everybody has the right to have any gun they want. Listen, if you want to talk about, even if what they said were true, the founding fathers, when they thought of guns, they thought of these single-shot blunderbusses, you know, where you got to take a rod, you got to push the powder down in the barrel, you got to put the ball from your pouch, you got to put the ball in there, you got to push that down in there, you understand, and then you got to cock it and then you shoot. That's what they had in mind. They certainly never had anything like AK-47s in mind. And you can just imagine that people of their intelligence would never have agreed that citizens should be free to walk around with these kind of weapons. So it's just nonsense, you know. And the best way to end this whole argument is to repeal the Second Amendment. Are you there?
Yeah, we're going to address Professor Mike Eric Dyson and his critique of the president. I think we have maybe 7 minutes, so I think you could probably take Dyson down in probably 5. Maybe, will you still have an extra minute for questions? Maybe we have time for a question. If you have questions, dial 805-727-7013. 805-727-7013. Professor Platel Benjamin, thinker.
Let me say this about Dyson. There's also an essay on the commentaries entitled "Less Preachers, More Policy Wonks." And this essay came about as a result of my listening to, looking at this, CNN did a thing called On the Black Agenda. And here was Cornel West and Michael Eric Dyson and, you know, Al Sharpton and just, I say, look, you know, first thing, if I had been producing this thing, Cornel West and and Michael Eric Jackson wouldn't have been on the program at all, all right? Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, they have earned the right to participate in any discussion about the future of black people by virtue of their years of activism, all right? So they have a right to participate in the discussion. But that's it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I said I would replace Michael Eric Dyson with Professor Bernard Anderson from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, a brilliant black economist who has been studying the position of black people in the American economy for over 50 years, you know, who is an emeritus professor now and who writes the economic section of the Urban League annual report on the state of black America. He's the foremost authority on the position of black people in the American economy and what should be done in terms of policy. And I would replace Cornel West with, and these are friends of mine, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I remember, I've known Bernie Anderson since he was writing his dissertation, you know, at the Wharton School. You know, I've known him over 50 years. Same thing with I would replace Cornel West with Dr. William J. Wilson. William J. Wilson now is a emeritus professor at Harvard, you know, and he's a sociologist, and he's the foremost authority on the problems of the black lower class. His books, the Truly Disadvantaged, When Work Disappears, these are the declining significance of race. These books are critical texts, canonical texts for anybody who want to understand the problems of the black lumping, you know, a black lower class, you understand, from which most of these crimes, where these murderous pathologies dwell. That these are the people who you should be listening to, not Cornel West and Michael Eric Dyson. These people are rhetoricians, you know. You have, you know, Michael Eric Dyson's, you know, I don't know how he ended up getting a professorship in sociology, you know, at Georgetown, because I haven't seen any sociological work, and he's not a trained sociologist. His training is he has a PhD in philosophy and religion, as does Cornel West, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, he's not qualified, you know, to be attempting to conduct the kind of analysis that he does. We have people who are far better qualified to engage in these discussions, but they're not verbose. And the reason you don't see them everywhere running their mouth is because they're doing serious work. You can't do serious work and be everywhere running your mouth all the time. That's the reason you don't see them.
I was going to ask you, we got a questioner from California, but let me ask you a quick question about Professor Glenn Lowry. Would you think he's qualified to opine on some of these issues?
Glenn Lowry is a real scholar, but the point was Glenn Lowry and I had a run-in one time when he was on the wrong side of the fence. He's come around a lot since then, but Glenn Lowry, early on, he had become kind of the bright new kid on the block for these and the right wing, you know, these conservatives were snatching him up. I ran into Glenn Lowry one morning in the train station about 1 o'clock in the morning once and ran up on him. He was sitting up in there eating some turtle soup and slurping and I didn't know who it was. I turned around and it was him. I said, "Damn, that's Glenn Lowry," you know. So I went over to him, you understand, saying I acted like I was you know, starstruck. You Professor Lowry, I seen you on TV. You understand what I'm saying? I baited him into a conversation with me, you know, and I got him into a conversation about affirmative action. At the time, I was working on a big piece on the construction industry here, which is also can be read on the commentaries. It's called Locked Out, The Case for Affirmative Action in the Construction Racket. This is a detailed look, you know, at the everything from the workers to the unions to architects, you know, to the contractors. This is a thorough look at race, you know, and organized crime, you know, in the construction industry. And I started hitting him with dropping science on him. Parker actually jumped up and ran away from me. He said, "Who are you? Who are you?" He said, "Who sent you?" And he got up and ran. I was running through I chased him through the train station saying, "Wait a minute, answer this, answer that." He was literally running from me, you know what I'm saying? But you know, he has a PhD in economics from MIT, you know, and now he's come to his senses and he's writing some interesting and useful stuff. So Glenn Lowry is somebody, I haven't seen what he's written lately, but anything he has written, I would give it a serious look.
Yeah, he happens to be a friend of mine. I hope he's listening, and I'm going to send him the tape. Cause I
hope
think we're
he remember running into me. I hope
I'd
he
like
remember
to,
running into me in Penn Station in Philadelphia when I ran
down there. You
know
what? I hope we can get here. I'd like to have you on with Michelle Alexander. We got to work on that. We have a call from 213.
Let me just say this. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, I don't want to hurt this young woman's feelings, and I'm not much in the mood for. You know, I mean, you know, I'm not debate with me is a blood sport. You understand what I'm saying?
I want a discussion. I don't want you to slaughter this young lady like you.
Well,
and,
I tell you what. Here's what I would do. I'm going to write a critique of what she's had to say about Clinton and this confrontation with Black Lives Matter, and a critique of her essay. And if she want to come on and respond to that, that's fine. But we have to
all
have
right,
some parameters.
All right, 213, you're on the air with the great Professor Playtell Benjamin.
Yeah, okay. Assalamu alaikum. How you doing?
Waalaikumsalam. How you doing, my dear brother?
Good. It's been a little while since we talked. But I was talking to an imam from Indiana a little while ago. And on his show tomorrow, they're going to discuss how is the masjid response to someone coming into the masjid who's a transsexual. Does this person go to a female bathroom in the masjid or a male bathroom? And these are the types of issues that are going to increasingly, now that our president, our dear president, that I think you defend, my brother, is that right?
I think Barack Obama is the greatest president. Obama is the greatest president in the history of the United States, period.
Yeah, okay.
My brother George, in all fairness to our guests.
Yes.
That's
I'll leave it alone this time.
Yeah, I want you to call that. I just want you to know, our guests here, we're discussing two limited issues. So I don't quite want to get into that one. We'll have another discussion when we have an in-house discussion. But
I have
right
no
now,
interest in that question
to
at
the
all.
Outside, and we have a distinguished person like Brother Playtell Benjamin. And I wanted to kind of keep it confined to that discussion.
Yeah, I have
all
no
right.
interest in that question, period. None.
But go ahead, Professor, if you'd like to be indulged. I don't mind
not
you being indulged.
I have
indulged,
no interest in that question. I don't have any interest in that question.
Okay, good. All right, good.
I have absolutely no interest in that question.
Brother George, I don't want to minimize you. You're a great supporter, but I am in all fairness, Professor. You can question me on that. I'll have some opinions on that.
I just have no interest in it. Yeah.
I just like to say this before I go, that if you're not against homosexuality, you're for it.
I don't care what you think about what I think about homosexuality. I mean, I don't
brother,
even care. That's not even a question I care about talking about. Let me say one thing. I
want to
make one comment about this. I have a standard answer. Let me answer this question. For people who say that they are against gay marriage, my response to them is, if you're against gay marriage, then don't marry anybody gay. Other than that, it's none of your damn business. All right? Period.
Okay.
That's my answer.
We have another question of Brother Playtell.
How you doing, Brother Playtell? My question
How you
is
doing?
This.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. My question is this. This phenomenon that we have from African Americans in the South voting for Hillary Clinton, and this is after it's come out that Bill Clinton brought down the three strike rule, that he was the one that he was one of the facilitators of putting our brothers in jail, that they did a number of other things to destroy our community, and yet we got these brothers, I mean, our women especially, voting for this female.
Obviously, you didn't hear what I had to say about that, did you?
No, sir.
Obviously, you didn't hear
later.
What I
was saying.
Well, listen,
you
should have been paying attention. It's too complicated a question to go into. Let me just say this. I went in at length and I talked about this at length, all right? And so I can't repeat all of this I've said before. I went into this question at length. Let me just put it this way. The bill that you were talking about, and obviously you don't even have your facts together. What you're talking about is the omnibus. Listen, what you're talking about is the omnibus crime bill, which Bill Clinton signed. Listen, which Bill Clinton signed into law, which we begged him to sign. I personally went down to Washington with my children, who had just missed being shot by a goddamn crack dealer, the 7-year-old kid, twins, and personally begged the New York congressional delegation to vote for this bill, and I danced for joy when Bill Clinton signed it. So if you want to be mad with somebody, be mad with all the law-abiding black citizens who were sick of these damn crack dealers who wanted that bill, all right? Okay? Be mad with me. Never mind Bill Clinton. Be mad with me. I was for it, and I don't regret it one minute. And when you talk about the bill destroying the black community, what was destroying the black community was these goddamn crack dealers shooting up everywhere. That's what was destroying the black community. We couldn't even let our children go out and play here. People were scared to go out to after dark, scared to even go to church. Now that stuff is all gone as a result of that bill. And one of the reasons why it's gone is because all those niggas are locked up and good riddance. I have no sympathy at all for them. Good riddance.
Yeah, but I'm just saying this is another kind.
They locked up good.
Yes. Let me show you.
Michelle Alexander, like this woman said today, that read this, Michelle, like, you're just trying to, a whole group of young black men. That's nonsense. I don't know one single person, there's not one young black man that I know. Nobody in my family, none of my friends, none of the children of my friends, who went to jail under that because they weren't dealing dope. Okay? They weren't dealing dope. They act like all these people that's locked up, they're all innocent. Yeah, right. You understand what I'm saying? The reason that we don't have them shooting up out here every day now is because their ass is off the street, and that's where they belong, in jail. I mean, I hear all of this black sob squad stuff. Listen, I was living here in the 1980s trying to raise children when they were out here shooting up everything all over. So I have no sympathy for any of them. As a matter of fact, I wrote a piece calling for them to go before a firing squad, and I volunteered in this piece that I just mentioned. You know, I volunteered to head the firing squad from Harlem. I wouldn't have had no hesitation about lining them up against the wall and shooting them on sight. Okay? So they got off easy under Clinton. Easy. Compared to what me and a lot of my neighbors would have done to them if we had been free to do it, what we wanted to do to them.
You're with us, Brother Playtown. Maybe we get more. Brother Playtell, he must have gone. Dear beloved people, we went over our time with Playtell Benjamin. And we thank you for tuning in to Religion Means Alive. We'll be on the air tomorrow at 3 o'clock where I will give my lecture. And we'll be back on Religion Means Alive Monday for our interview. Tuesday we'll be on. Wednesday I'll be back at the interview station again. Thursday I'll be on, and I'll be back on again Saturday. So I'm back on the air, and I thank you. And to Brother George in Los Angeles, if you'd like to discuss that question, I would love to have you back on to discuss it. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You've listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive.